This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of September 4th, here are a few top stories. In the news, President Trump made an announcement about immigrants in the U.S. who are part of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Here's the show's Steve Goldstein and Lauren Gilger with one family who is struggling to figure out what to do next.
Angelica Hernandez and Juan Amaya are living the American dream. They worked hard in school, paid their way through college, and now both work as engineers in the Valley. Along the way, they fell in love, got married, bought a house, and had two little girls, one who is two and a newborn who's just 3 months old. But neither of them could have done it without DACA, the Obama-era program that has protected so-called dreamers from deportation since 2012. The show's Lauren Gilger sat down with the couple recently to talk about the president's decision to phase out the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program this week. And she joins us now. Lauren, first question is kind of obvious, but what could this mean for their kids?
Right, and that is the question. And honestly, they don't really know the answer at this point. DACA recipients are all young. In order to qualify, they had to be under the age of 31 in 2012 when the program began. And they were all brought here by their parents when they were children. Under the program, they've been able to get work permits for jobs, go to college, and get driver's licenses for the first time. And now many of them have children of their own who are U.S. citizens. So the Trump administration's announcement this week to end the program has left them grappling with some serious questions about the future of their families. I spoke with Juan and Angelica about their worries for their children and their reaction to the news this week.
I think for me, it was something that President Trump had announced throughout his campaign that he was going to get rid of DACA. So in a sense, it was something that was like always hanging, you know, in the back of our mind that it was something that could happen. But I feel like after the announcement, it's when it really sunk in. And I think you personally, I was just, I felt really overwhelmed with uncertainty of what would happen and what this meant. And having been through this application process and renewed, a couple of times for a work permit, and knowing that now they had all of our information that they asked us, okay, trust in the government that we're going to be able to protect you from deportation if you provide all of your information. Now they were documented, right? Like now they have us in the system. And so now knowing that trust has been broken was the hardest part, because I feel like as parents and as the providers for our family and for our parents, you know, it's definitely something that is scary at this point.
So my initial reaction was, the very first thing that came to my mind was our children. You know, I kind of was expecting it, but you still don't know how to react when you hear about it, especially because now we have two girls. And, you know, I just can't imagine one day looking into my two-year-old daughter and, you know, saying bye to her because I'm being removed from the country. I can't even imagine that.
Right. And so that's a big question, I think, hanging out there right now. You have a two-year-old, you have a three-month-old daughter. Do you have any idea how this could affect them if it is the case that in a few years or in a few months you have to leave?
I think that's always been a problem, and I think it's something that you have so many mixed-status families now. And you always hear about the different effects of parents being removed or put in deportation proceedings, and now the children are here. They come home one day and their parents are gone, right? They're not coming back. And I think that's always been something that needs some kind of legislation that would be able to resolve that. Obviously, the DREAM Act only looks at young adults that came here with their parents. But at this point, we've grown up. We're adults, and a lot of us are having children. So it's at this point, if they were to remove us from the country, I mean, what would happen to our daughters, right? And just thinking of the anxiety that they would feel and not even knowing what's happening because they're so little, right? Yeah. And so it's something that definitely hits close to heart, and definitely can see the pain that a lot of families have gone through that have been separated.
Yeah. What are your plans at this point? What can you do? You said you might consult an immigration attorney.
Yeah, so as far as our, you know, right now we're just exploring all our options. We're going to sit down with an attorney and see what options there are for us, or how to have a plan for, you know, for whatever reason me and my wife are to be removed from the country. We want to be able to reunite with our children as fast as possible. So, you know, we sitting down with an attorney and seeing what options there are to make that an easier process is what we're considering, you know, as first priority. Once we have that plan set and done, then we'll have to sit down and kind of strategize on what we're going to do with this news.
I wonder, so all of this seems to be pinned on legislation from Congress right now. I wonder, what is it that you would like to see Congress do if they do, in fact, pass some sort of immigration reform that addresses this in the next 6 months?
Well, I think right now, if anything positive coming out of this is really seeing the momentum and how many people are outraged and how many people are prepared and fired up to do something. I mean, we started advocating for the DREAM Act back in 2006, 2007, right? It's already been more than 10 years. And we've never seen a momentum like this. Obviously, it would be a first good step, right, to be able to pass the DREAM Act, but at the same time not forget about the rest of the undocumented community that is still looking for something to protect them.
If I may just add, I really am just looking forward for both Democrats and Republicans to sit down and get something done. I've always felt that we've always been political pawns to them, and whoever has the White House is going to use us as an advantage. And so I know to them it's a political tool, but to us it's something personal. It's something that's affecting our lives every single day. So I just hope that they can actually sit down and genuinely want to do something, because our lives depend on it and our children depend on it. So I just really hope that they're serious for once, and that all this momentum that's been created doesn't go to waste.
Juan Amaya and Angelica Hernandez, thank you both for coming in.
Yeah, thank you for having
us. Thank you.
And now from the binational episode of the show, here's Jorge Valencia.
In Arizona, it's very likely you know about one famous architect, born at the turn of the 20th century and celebrated worldwide, even without any formal architecture training. His style celebrated a social rebelliousness years ahead of his time and respected the exterior and landscapes just as much as interior spaces. In the late 90s, he was the subject of an ASU symposium compiled in a book titled The Phoenix Papers. But it's not Frank Lloyd Wright we're talking about. This international symposium accolades were focused on another architect, Luis Barragán of Mexico City. And the Phoenix Papers captured a moment of magic between the capital cities of Mexico and Arizona. The show's Paige Phelps has more.
In the world of architecture, drawing is essential to communication. Back when hand drawing was actually taught in schools, the weight of a line was a system of drawing to show what was important to the design. So let's draw our own imaginary line in architectural history directly from Phoenix, Arizona to Mexico City. Without this line, a unique and important architect wouldn't be known the way he is today. We're speaking of Luis Barragán, who well before his time created buildings that blurred the line between art and sculpture, giving modernism its first foothold in a country where tradition is king. But who was Luis Barragán? That was the initial mystery Ignacio San Martin, a former professor at ASU's architecture school, set out to answer.
He didn't talk to too many people. He was extremely private. He lived by himself. He never married. He lived in his kind of his cave, call it a cave, but his little environment, and he just was not a person who talked about himself. So it was this mystery about the person.
San Martin was in Berkeley when Barragán won the coveted Pritzker Prize for Architecture, only the second architect to win it in its history. And he remembers Barragán's unique style blew him and his peers away.
I mean, we were totally, my God, what is this? Color in architecture? What is this? You know, chromatic differences on walls?
Luis Barragán's style, filled with enormous scale, can make a person feel small and somehow safe at the same time. And it's paired with his dramatic use of color, most famously his Rosa Mexicano, a red pink he was known for. And his work slowly gained accolades over the years until it seemed to truly capture the zeitgeist in the late 70s and early 80s.
San Martin, a Spanish national, was asked by the Harvard Journal to compile new data on the then-deceased architect. He immediately headed to Mexico City to find out more, but he soon hit a dead end.
When I went to Mexico, I found very quickly that you could not all the information, paper, drawings, letters, car, were completely sealed and you could not touch.
He told Harvard there was no way to study Barragán any further. And that's where our current knowledge of Barragán might have stalled. But San Martín had another idea. To search for the man Luis Barragán through his colleagues, his peers, the artists who worked alongside him to document his spaces. So San Martín created the Phoenix Papers as a symposium where craftsmen would gather and give their own perspectives of the man, Barragán, and his artistry.
If we invite them, they will give a lecture. Each of them will give a lecture about their way of understanding Luis Barragán and how they work with him. So it may very well be that uncovers who this man is.
Unlike other lauded architects, Barragán's portfolio and accolades are relatively small. He never did a skyscraper or an office building, for instance. No shopping centers, no hospitals. So why is it Luis Barragán is even important? Because he was doing something completely different, San Martín says.
The first home that he did, which had that patio courtyard, to express intimacy, the intimacy of the home. He have always have that passion for intimacy.
And then there was that color.
One of the things that his architecture is that you cannot think about Mexico without color. There is so much good art in color. So it's very, very difficult to be around Mexico and not being flooded by texture and color. And I think that what he was able to do is doing modern architecture, but bring into that modern architecture color and texture, which is culturally what Mexico is. Nobody in Europe or in the United States during the modern movement will even think to have texture on the exterior walls or color on the exterior walls. Architects never understood color or never been taught about color. So we will never have done it. It's white upon white, and perhaps if you find that a better white, let's do a better white. That's all.
Like Frank Lloyd Wright, Barragán never got a degree in architecture. In fact, he didn't even draw like a traditional architect. He drew freehand, capturing the spirit of a home, the feeling he wanted to convey rather than straight lines. This, along with his unorthodox design style, didn't go over very well with his architecture contemporaries in Mexico. But Luis Barragán wasn't interested in fitting in. He wanted something new.
A building is a building. Dwelling is being inside with as representation of yourself. That's the space in which talks to you. And dwelling is very different than making a building or building. Building is construction, dwelling is inhabiting. Luis knew that very, very well. The idea that architecture is about creating spaces, and this is a phrase from him, in which you can really find yourself. That involves a way of thinking about architecture, about dwelling and culture and climate.
So what did the Phoenix Papers do? They illuminated how Barragán thought, how he worked day to day, how all those little mysteries made up his designs that were less about buildings and more about surprising sculptures that captured Mexico's modern spirit.
I was looking for who are the people who work with Barragán in his studio. Are they still around? Well, I were able to talk to all of them. Of course, after that you say, and what do I do with all of them? Rather than me writing a paper or a book about Luis Barragán, it is a collection, the Phoenix paper, in which all of these people speak. And I think that that's the value of the book.
25 years later, contemporary forms in Mexican architecture aren't unusual anymore. For example, the Museo Sumaya is a silver hexagonal tornado twist, housing a world-renowned art collection. These forms of flash and power pop up all the time now in Mexico City. But San Martín says Barragán should continue to be studied for the delicate qualities he brought to his bold spaces.
If somebody's interested and somebody have a good keen eye to figure out how architecture can mutate to be more than just four walls and a bed, if somebody's interested about the nature of dwelling and being and existing and so forth, I think that it will look at Barragán.
And all this time later, if it wasn't for the efforts of ASU's Phoenix Papers, this exploration would have been blocked from curious future generations. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Paige Phelps.
You're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. After months of work, state health officials have issued a broad set of recommendations to Governor Doug Ducey on how to combat the opioid epidemic. KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
Limiting the first prescription to 5 days, more closely regulating pain clinics, requiring pharmacists to check what other medications patients are taking. Those are just some of the proposals that the Department of Health Services believes will help curb the opioid epidemic, which is claiming 2 lives in the state every day. The agency listed more than a dozen steps that can be taken. Some require state legislation, while others federal intervention. Ducey spokesperson Daniel Scarpinato said the governor's optimistic some of these ideas can be turned into law.
We really see this as a totally nonpartisan issue. I think Republicans and Democrats are seeing these numbers, and there's an opportunity here to save lives.
The state hopes to reduce the number of opioid-related deaths by 25% over the next 5 years. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Now let's look at some developments in education this week.
Less than half of Arizona students passed most sections of the Easy Merit Test. That's the state's standardized exam, which is aligned with the Arizona College and Career Ready standards. The results released yesterday do show some improvement from 2016 in areas including 6th and 7th grade math and 3rd and 4th grade English. And the show's Mark Brody is here with more on the results. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Steve. Yeah, in a statement, State School Superintendent Diane Douglas says she's pleased scores are, quote, modestly moving in the right direction. And to get some perspective on the results, I spoke earlier with Stacey Morley. She's Government Affairs Director with Stanford Children Arizona, and I asked her what she makes of the numbers.
Well, I think it's a good sign that we have, a slight increase in scores over the last, since we started administering the new assessment. Overall, it's still disheartening at how poorly our students are performing overall, and especially when you get into the higher grades, the performance drop-off is pretty significant in all the tested areas.
Yeah, I'm curious, in those upper grades, the upper levels of high school, how concerning is it that those numbers don't really seem to be getting a lot better? Some of the younger grades do, but as the students get older, it seems like they're at least the last couple of years kind of leveling off.
Well, it's like a compounding, right? If you're struggling to read at third grade, even if you pass, but you have a struggle to read at third grade, it only gets harder. There's a saying that until third grade, you're learning to read, and after third grade, you read to learn. So if you are not reading on grade level proficiently at third grade, at entering into fourth grade, you're going to have problems comprehending material as you go on through your academic years. And the same thing can be said with math. If you, it's very foundational. So, even though we do better in the lower grades, we're not doing well enough for our kids to really have long-term academic success.
When AZ Merit came along, there was a lot of discussion that, at least at the beginning, the scores would be lower, trying to warn people and maybe lower expectations. It was a harder test than the old test called AIMS. And there was a lot of discussion about we just have to let students get used to the test and the scores will start coming up. Is this kind of what you expected at that time, or are we not at the point at which you thought we would be when AZ Merit was started?
No, I mean, I believe that basically with the old assessment, it tested the old standards, and our old standards were far below what our kids really needed to know. So we were actually doing, a really big disservice to our kids. We're graduating them saying, you're ready to go to high school, you did so well on AIMS, but the fact, and you're ready to go on into college. But the fact was that our standards and our assessments were not up to par of where you really need to be ready to take on those harder classes and tasks. So when we increased our standards, we had to obviously increase the rigor of the assessment to test those higher expectations. So basically, we've raised the expectations for all kids, and the assessment is testing that. So we definitely knew that there was going to be a drop in scores, and that, as kids got used to the test and used to the standards, and that's also probably why some of the higher grades are not doing as well, since they basically went through half of their school academic life under the old standards, and then we change them. And part of it is, you know, we haven't fully funded our schools since the recession, and so we adopted new standards and a new assessment without providing enough money for schools to really properly implement.
How much of these scores do you attribute to the state's level of funding for Arizona schools, and how much might be related to other things?
I don't know that you can actually put, like, you know, it's not that simple, right? So some schools are still doing a really good job using their money efficiently and effectively. So it's not just about more money. It's about where you're using it, the decisions you make at a local level. But just because some schools do better with less doesn't mean that less is okay. I think the big piece that hasn't been restored for funding in the formula is the piece that allows schools to purchase new curriculum, technology, textbooks, materials, that type of stuff. You know, it's almost about $400 per kid in the school districts and $200 per kid in the charter schools. And when you're talking about completely changing the level of the subject matter you're teaching in each grade, that's a lot to implement without having the proper materials to support teachers in the classroom.
So do you think that in order to raise the scores, it's a matter of more money? I mean, is that the piece? Is that the biggest piece? Or are there other things that also need to happen?
I don't think it's the piece. I think it's a piece. It would make it easier for schools to do professional development on the teachers and help support what's going on in the classroom more. But I don't think, I mean, money is not a panacea. It just doesn't solve all problems. I think that obviously we need to focus our efforts and see what's working in the schools that are doing really, really well, especially with our more challenged populations. We need to see what they're doing and try to replicate that in our other schools.
Stacey Morley is the Government Affairs Director with Stand for Children Arizona. Stacey, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks.
International oil corporations are rushing to the Mexican side of the Gulf of Mexico, and the interest in its deep water reserves has come from global big guns like ExxonMobil and even the Chinese government, to the tune of an expected $60 billion in investment. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia has been looking into Mexico's newly opened energy sector. He reports on how one of the country's most struggling states is hoping to capitalize on this black gold rush.
Right in the middle of Mexico's Gulf Coast is a long strip, the state of Veracruz. And here in the biggest city, also called Veracruz, is a convenience store chain called Super Little Jesus. Bright, tropical music plays outside one store, but owner Jesus Antonio Munoz has much to be unhappy about.
It has been a very sad period that we live here in Veracruz.
Robberies are common enough that some of his employees are scared of going to work. And there's worse.
Several of our colleagues, our friends that have businesses here, they have decided to go live any other place because of the fear of being kidnapped or because they had been kidnapped.
Munoz says the previous government sometimes extorted businesses or didn't pay out large contracts with construction companies.
Yeah, every time it comes to the talk, but we don't want to talk about it. We want to give all the world good news about Veracruz.
This is Alejandro Zairik Morante,
the Secretary of Economic and Port Development. In Veracruz.
Zairik came in with a new administration this year. The former governor, Javier Duarte, is now in jail. So, Zairik says there's a new day and brand new interest in the state's energy economy. There's solar, wind, gas, and oil. Zairik says estimates show 40% of Mexico's oil reserves are right here in Veracruz.
Of course, 40% of the whole country reserves are here in Veracruz. So, we are like the center of the energy reform.
Mexico is in the early stages of what could become a black gold rush. The government is dismantling its decades-old monopoly on oil extraction. It's hoping corporations will set up more than 200 wells in the Gulf. Veracruz officials want to capitalize on that by building a port specifically to serve those wells.
We now have some port developers. We have refineries. And some other services that are very useful for all the companies offshore. So we have all the pieces.
The port would be in what's currently a small fishing town called Alvarado. It's geographically in the center of Mexico's Gulf Coast. And Zairik says the river that meets the ocean there is more than 40 feet deep, big enough for deep draft ships. Veracruz has no money to build the port, so it would have to be done with private partnerships. SIDEC's team wants to replicate the success of a port a few hundred miles north.
All right, it is Port Fouchon.
Davey Bro oversees construction at Port Fouchon in Louisiana. That port accounts for more than 90% of the deepwater oil production in the U.S. Over the last 20 years, Bro has seen the port grow from 14 tenants to more than 250. It is by far the biggest economic engine in southern Louisiana.
If you need a piece of property, you will be waiting about a year and a half, and that's in a slow time. Sorry.
Bro says operating a well costs more than $1 million per day, which is why they need a port nearby with supplies. Veracruz officials visited Port Fouchon this year, and Bro told them the port has been around for more than 50 years.
So, you know, it's hard to build a Fouchon tomorrow.
Here in Alvarado, third-generation fisherman Jaime Santiago says that even though the project for his hometown would represent new wealth for his state and country, he's worried.
O sea, no nos preocupa, nos re-preocupa, nos tiene super, pues saber qué va a pasar.
He says he doesn't know how the town's fishers would fit in with the new port. He asks, who's going to explain it to us? Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, reporting from Veracruz.
And finally, in business news, beer is made from four primary ingredients: grain, hops, yeast, and water. But many craft breweries experiment. They've added everything from hatch chilies to pumpkin and even candy bars. As KJZZ's Mariana Dale reports, a group of Arizona breweries took on an ingredient most people have never tasted.
Inside Renhouse Brewing Company in Central Phoenix, the air is humid and filled with the smell of grain.
Yep, today's is boiling.
There's quite a bit of science in brewing, and it starts with the water.
It'd be tough to use the same water for a porter and for an IPA. You're looking for different levels of everything from chlorine to salt to all types of minerals.
Preston Taney is head brewer. A few months ago, he pitched a new idea to the team. Why don't we brew a great beer from purified wastewater? That's right, wastewater.
The first comment was, but why would we do that? You know, we have water.
He explained it was for a contest run by Pima County's Southwest Water Campus to raise awareness about an untapped source of drinking water that typically ends up on golf courses and in dry riverbeds.
Water is such a big part of brewing. Obviously, it's the bulk of what we use to make beer. It's nice to have different avenues to make sure that we always have a sustainable source of water, even in a big city in the desert like Phoenix.
And those are the types of conversations contest creators like University of Arizona microbiologist Chana Rock wanted to start.
If I go out and I talk about water, you know, I'll get a small subset of the population who will either find that interesting or want to pay attention to me. But when I talk about beer coupled with water, I might get a few more, you know, nodding heads and a little bit more interest.
The goal, besides spurring the creation of delicious beer, is to highlight emerging technology that purifies wastewater to drinkable standards.
In Arizona, it's not going to be tomorrow that we need to use these technologies, but maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, we want to be prepared.
The 500 gallons of reclaimed water Renhouse got to make their beer came from a Phoenix water treatment plant. Then it went through a 5-step process, including reverse osmosis, carbon filtering, and ultrafiltration to remove any bacteria.
The water that we're producing through our treatment process is tested and validated, both in real time, which means that we're taking measurements as we're treating the water, as well as collecting samples and sending them off to contract labs.
This could be the first time Arizonans taste recycled water. Here's why.
In Arizona's current regulations, it is not legal to reuse water for a drinking water purpose.
Trevor Bajori is Arizona's Water Quality Division Director. He says this contest has a special permit, but soon recycled water could reach a larger audience.
We have a reclaimed water system now. It limits the best uses of that water. Technology has advanced to the point where that water can be used for higher-end uses.
The Arizona Department of Environmental Quality is reviewing Arizona's drinking water regulations, and new rules that would allow wastewater to be treated for drinking could be adopted early next year. Back at Renhouse, head brewer Taney says he'd use this water again.
It's the cleanest water we've ever brewed with.
The water became Hydrologic, a cloudy golden pale ale.
We used hops that were super citrusy, gave almost a sweetness, candied orange peel, Sunny D, a lot of those really bright, sweet flavors.
So the brewer calls his work a success. But what really matters if you're trying to sell a beer or the idea of recycled water is whether people like it.
Today, from Hydrologic.
Rebecca Christie was at the tap room on a recent afternoon. She takes a swig of Hydrologic.
I think that the notes on it are really nice. There's a lot of aroma to it, but also I enjoyed the freshness of it.
Then I tell her where the water to make the beer came from.
Oh, nice. Okay, I didn't catch that.
Yeah. Knowing that, does that like change what you think about the beer?
I guess that would change my thoughts, but it wouldn't keep me from drinking it. I think that's cool that we're finding different ways to use our sources and not create extra waste.
The consensus at the tap room was that if the beer's good, recycled water is fine too. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.